Panic grief. Panic grief is the space of lost connection, loneliness, and abandonment. Because love is a biological drive, meaning we can die if we don't get enough, this space is an alert system to tell us when we're feeling too alone. Panic is the warning of isolation. Grief is feeling helpless and hopeless. Panic grief is directly connected to whether or not we are receiving enough care. At its simplest, panic grief is loneliness. But loneliness is like hunger. It's an alarm sounding, telling us to fix a problem that could lead to serious harm. You see, a human infant's life literally depends on their adult caregivers. So our brains have a powerful panic grief warning system that alerts us that bad things could happen if no one comes to us when we need help. The absence of a caregiver activates panic in young humans, tears and wailing and efforts to find or engage with the caregiver. If the caregiver still doesn't come back, behavior transitions into the grief half of panic grief, sadness, and if the isolation goes on too long, eventually hopeless despair. Around adolescence, the care system gets co-opted, and our peers become our attachment objects. By adulthood, our lives no longer literally depend on our attachment object coming back, but our bodies don't know that. So separation from a lover can feel like you're dying. They call it heartbreak for a reason. Like all these primary emotional spaces, panic grief has a range of intensities that modulate how easy it is to move from there to lust. At lower intensities, panic grief can fuel many different kinds of lustful experiences. Jessamine Stanley, a polyamorous queer yoga teacher, said on her podcast, "Jealousy is my kink." When her nestmate was developing a relationship with a new partner, it activated a low-level sense of threat to the attachment, a tension that in turn activates lust as a way to reinforce the bond in their relationship. Sometimes, breakups and major arguments can also catapult us from panic grief to lust. When our connection with the other person is destabilized, our brains will harness every tool they have to stabilize the connection. Sex is one of the ways we stabilize, reinforce, and even restore connection with our peers. Hence, breakup sex and makeup sex. The stakes of breakup and makeup sex may feel life-threateningly high. Hence, all the breakup and makeup sex in soap operas, movies, and romance novels. These stories construct sexual touch almost exclusively as a way to ease panic grief. No one ever feels actual pleasure or joy, just relief. I want more for your sex life than relief from existential despair. I want joy for you. But for some people, the least hint of jealousy or discord can lock the door to lust. A friend of mine with a significant history of abusive relationships told me that it has taken him a long time to learn that it's okay when his partner spends time with other people. For most of his life, if a partner expressed any admiration for someone else, his brain just assumed the relationship was over. His partner was going to leave him for this other person. And so rather than panicking and trying to repair the relationship, his body would shut down and disengage completely. As you consider the panic grief space in your emotional mind, ask yourself the questions. How do you know you're in that space? What happens in your body, thoughts, and emotions when you're there? How do you feel about this space? What spaces are adjacent? What pushes you into that space and what pulls you out? Notice that this is different from the first four spaces. In general, we are pulled into positive emotions and pushed into the negative emotions. Fear. Fear is the space of unsafe, move away. At its lowest intensity, it might be a slight niggling worry. At higher intensities, it can be full terror. It can also show up as people-pleasing, doing whatever it takes to create a sense of safety. In everyday language, fear is everything from slight worry to anxiety to terror. Fear is amazing because it could be three different things: flight, fawn, and freeze. Not fight. Fight is rage, which we'll talk about next. Fear's classic outward manifestation is flight, a chaotic projectile movement to get out of harm's way. According to Jaak Panksepp, evolutionarily, fear is there to help us survive life-threatening situations like being chased by a predator. And when you're being chased by something with teeth and claws that can run 30 miles an hour and wants to eat you, there is no need for curiosity or sex. What you need is to survive. So fear may include reduced positive affect, that is, an inhibition of the favorable systems of play, seeking, care, and lust. Or it can show up as something sometimes called fawn or tend and befriend, a highly social threat response that causes us to seek connection as a way of finding safety. We smile and placate a dangerous-seeming person, especially those with power over us. We protect and take care of the vulnerable people around us to try to make them safe in an unsafe situation. We look to the faces of the people around us, seeking reassurance that we're not alone in this threatening situation. We run to someone safe and hold on hard to them. This version of fear may involve the care system, but it's in the kitchen of care, with a hot stove, covered in pans, filled with boiling oil, and you can't look away for a second for fear of fire. But fear can also show up as freeze, where you shut down, collapse, long for sleep, can't speak or think clearly, can barely move, or feel you're in a fog, moving in slow motion. Freeze is our last-ditch fear response, when your brain has lost hope that you can escape the threat, or defeat the threat, or persuade the threat to go away. Sometimes people talk about it as going into shock, or playing dead. Physiologically, your brain and body are waiting for the threat to pass and for help to come. Given that a significant proportion of people have experienced sexual trauma, often including the experience of freeze, it's not rare for lust to have a one-way door directly into fear. Here's one example of getting stuck in fear when you may want to get to lust. If you're a survivor of sexual violence, you may prefer to skip to the end of this section. A young woman experienced a traumatic groping where a man approached her from behind and grabbed her genitals with his hand and pressed his genitals against her back. This was in public, in a store, in full daylight. This guy just grabbed her and groped her and then walked away. She never even saw his face. Her body shut down, going straight to freeze. In a haze, she left the store, made her way home, and got into bed, hiding under the covers, and waited until she was able to cry. Then she did her best to forget about it. Years later, she was in a relationship and happy. She and her partner moved in together, and things were going well. Then one day, as she was standing at the sink washing dishes, her partner came home and wrapped his arms around her from behind. Her body freaked out. Her arms went in front of her face and her body froze, trembling with tension. The past incident had created a trap door in her brain so that when her partner approached her from behind, she fell helplessly into fear. And the only path out of the fear went through rage. She became angry with herself for being irrational. Then she was angry with her partner for surprising her that way. Then she was angry at her groper for creating this emotional trap in her brain. But mostly, she was just angry and looking for a target, and there wasn't one, and so she got stuck. Worst of all, that trap door expanded and generalized to other sexual touch, whether being held from behind or not. Eventually, almost any sexual touch would send her down through the trap door into fear. What did they do? Well, they talked about it. They made a plan to try safe, controlled touch together and gradually, over weeks, increase the intimacy of their shared touch, teaching her body that sexual touch could happen in a safe enough context. Just as the trapdoor into fear could grow, it could also be shrunk by practicing touch in the context of safety. Do I have to mention they worked with a therapist? If you or a partner are a survivor of sexual violence, there may be nothing more powerful than exploring how your brain has linked lust and fear based on your life experience, and gently allowing your brain to learn to experience sexual stimulation in the context of safety. Training your brain to unlink fear and lust takes time and love, like training a puppy. If you get frustrated or impatient, you only make the puppy feel shy and worried. Your fearful brain is like that puppy. Treat it with love, patience, and appreciation for how hard it's trying to do things right, and it will learn that it is safe. It will relax and blossom. A necessary caveat about fear. If your fear derives not from past experiences or worries about the future, but from your current partner, that's a sign that something very serious is going wrong in your relationship. If you're afraid of your partner, if your partner shames you for your fear, if you get into a fear space and can't find a way out, therapy. Those are bigger, more fundamental problems than a book can help you with. Fear is a part of life. The goal is not to live without fear, but to live with it in ways that let you move through it, rather than allowing it to decide what you do or don't do in your life. Audre Lorde offered poetic wisdom about living with fear in her cancer journals. She wrote, "I am learning to live beyond fear by living through it, and in the process, learning to turn fury at my own limitations into some more creative energy. If I cannot banish fear completely, I can learn to count with it less. For then fear becomes not a tyrant against which I waste my energy fighting, but a companion, not particularly desirable, yet one whose knowledge can be useful." If fear is a regular part of your life, let it become a useful companion, however unpleasant. As you consider the fear space in your emotional mind, ask yourself the questions. How do you know you're in that space? What happens in your body, thoughts, and emotions when you're there? How do you feel about this space? What spaces are adjacent? What pushes you into that space? And what pulls you out? Depression and anxiety and the emotional floor plan. If anxiety is or has been a part of your life, as it has been a part of mine, you'll recognize the physical, mental, or emotional turmoil of an ungrounded urge to escape, avoid, or chaotically attempt to control your environment. Whether you experience social anxiety, phobias, obsessive or compulsive behaviors or thoughts such as disordered eating, picking at your skin, or pulling out your hair, or counting, tapping, or checking things like locked doors, etc. General anxiety, or all of these, anxiety is your body's way of trying to keep you safe in situations it has been trained to perceive as unsafe. Learning to notice when you're in the fear space and to ease your body through and out of it is the essential skill of reducing the impact of anxiety on your life. And of course, reducing the impact of anxiety on your life can only increase your brain's access to pleasure and lust. Similarly, panic grief is where depression lives. And for most people, the intensity of panic grief is an emotional swamp, making it difficult to get to any favorable spaces, including lust. If depression is or has been a part of your life, as it has been a part of mine, you may be familiar with the shadows of helplessness and isolation that seem to follow you around in this space. This is why many of the effective treatments for depression involve bodily autonomy and social connection, especially play. Physical activity teaches your body that you are not trapped and helpless, whatever your brain's opinion might be. Connection with others teaches you that you are not alone, and thus that you do not, in fact, deserve to be alone. Learning to notice when you're in the panic grief space and to ease your body through and out of it is the essential skill of reducing the impact of depression on your life. In Chapter 5, you'll find the relationship skills that facilitate working as a team. Rage. Rage is the space of unsafe, move to destroy. It can be as small as annoyance or irritation, and as large as a body-filling, Hulk-like need to smash. No emotion is inherently dangerous, but because rage is the motivation to break things, we have to be sure we don't trust our hands or our words when rage is intensely activated. Known in everyday language by names like anger, annoyance, irritation, frustration, or sometimes hatred, rage is the attack mode of the stress response. It is the biological impulse to move toward and destroy something we perceive as a threat to our safety, well-being, identity, or goals. What are some things that activate rage inside you? What causes hate to rise, making you want to destroy or wish something or someone would cease to exist? Of all the rooms in your emotional floor plan, rage is the room people have the most complicated feelings about. It's a space many of us have been taught we don't or shouldn't have. And if you can't recognize that you're in rage, that makes it pretty difficult to get out. My general advice for addressing intense anger in a relationship is, when you're deep in the rage room, no touching each other, not with any part of your body. Also, no words. You can growl and pound on your chest like a gorilla. You can jump up and down or go for a run or emit a primal scream with your partner to purge the rage from your body. Feelings are tunnels. You have to go through them to get to the light at the end. But no words and no touching, not even directed towards yourself. Your anger is not inherently harmful, and if you don't use your body or words as weapons, the mere existence of your anger is not dangerous. Nor is your partner's anger inherently harmful, and if they do not use their body or words as weapons, the mere existence of their anger is not dangerous. You can be angry in each other's presence. You can even be angry with each other. And nothing is wrong. Another necessary caveat, like the one for fear. If your partner uses their rage to excuse using their body or words as a weapon against you, or if you allow yourself to cause harm to your partner because you lost your temper, something seriously not okay is happening. Seek professional intervention. What can we do in the rage space? We purge. We throw stuff into trash bags and out the metaphorical window. We allow the tide of the emotion to flood through us and to dissipate. We do not tie the physiology of our emotion to any thoughts or ideas. We don't believe anything we tell ourselves. It's not possible to distinguish between truth and self-serving lies in the rage room. We pull weeds from the metaphorical garden. A friend of mine had gotten as far as acknowledging that she had a rage space on her emotional floor plan. She could even recognize that she was in it. What my friend asked, though, was not how to deal with rage. It was, how am I supposed to want sex when I have all this rage? At first, I didn't understand the question. I asked her to explain, and she described all her frustrations from years of feeling like a subordinate, she said. It was a role she was raised to believe was her duty. But after decades of marriage, she had grown more and more disillusioned with those beliefs and more frustrated as her husband made no space for her to pursue her own dreams, as he failed to accept more responsibility for day-to-day householding and helping with the kids now in their teens, and as he minimized her distress and told her she was just better at these things, and why was she angry? That was a compliment. Over time, her rage had accumulated and calcified into a wall of contempt. She asked again, "How do I want sex in the midst of all this?" "Well, first of all," I said, "it's not desire that matters, it's pleasure. But you don't have to want or like sex all the time. You don't have to keep trying to get to lust. You can just focus on getting through rage. There's no reason to want or like sex if you're spending a lot of time in the rage space. With that said, we are often taught that rage and lust are closely linked and maybe even belong together. It's a lie, but it's so ubiquitous that it's only natural you would believe it. We grow up accepting the neurologically silly notion that wanting to approach someone to destroy them must be very similar to wanting to approach someone to share an erotic experience. It shows up in pop culture all the time. Side eye to the 2005 Pride and Prejudice, in which Darcy and Lizzie almost kiss immediately after she explains to him all the ways she hates him. In rage-motivated lust, you want to fuck someone as a way to destroy them. But that's not sex. That's sexual violence, using sex as a weapon against someone. And a blanket no to that. Never try to destroy someone with sex without their full, free consent. We all get that, right? It's the 21st century. We understand that using sex to hurt, punish, or destroy someone is always, always bad, right? Okay, good. Are there times when rage and lust can coexist? Sure, I can think of at least two. First, some breakup sex and makeup sex may fall into this category, though I think panic grief is more usual. When there's an argument in an established relationship and the conflict creates a threat to the attachment bond, humans use sex as an attachment behavior to reinforce and heal damage to attachment. These kinds of experiences blend care with rage and lust. A second possibility involves one partner happily consenting to being destroyed with sex while another person happily consents to do it. It's nearly always metaphorical destruction and highly stylized rage. These kinds of experiences blend play with rage and lust. It calls for exceptionally good communication skills so you can stay clear about boundaries even during intense emotional experiences. This kind of play nearly always happens in a pre-existing relationship grounded in trust. Whether through care or play, skilled partners integrate rage with lust by choosing a shared target for their rage. They don't want to destroy their partner. They want to destroy, say, a person who did them harm in the past, or a subject of conflict in the relationship, or an unchosen, unwanted part of themselves. They may play pretend, acting like one of them is the person who did harm, but the partner is never the literal target of rage. Please, let's retire the angry sex narrative and replace it with playful sex. So much better for all of us. Wanting to destroy someone and wanting to connect erotically are not related, except under specific, fairly extraordinary circumstances. Rage has a place in our lives and in our relationships and even in our eroticism. It is an important and wholesome dimension of our internal lives. But it's complicated because it is the biology of destruction, domination, and control. It's also complicated because our relationship to our own and other people's anger has been shaped our whole lives by cultural messages, as I'll discuss in the coming chapters. But for now, the moral of the story is, when we are in the rage space, no hands, no words. Don't go into lust from rage unless you and your partner are making mutual and intentional choices. Never engage sexually with someone you feel an impulse to destroy. As you consider the rage space in your emotional mind, ask yourself the questions. How do you know you're in that space? What happens in your body, thoughts, and emotions when you're there? How do you feel about this space? What spaces are adjacent? What pushes you into that space, and what pulls you out? 2 bonus spaces. In addition to the 7 primary process emotions as outlined by Jaak Panksepp, I want to add 2 further spaces in your floor plan. These are not emotions, but they are crucial influences on our sexualities and our relationships, and they deserve space on a floor plan that explores where you might be relative to your lust space. The first bonus space is your thinking mind. I often imagine the thinking mind as an office where your thinking, planning, worrying, ruminating, cognition, and social appropriateness live. It's where people get stuck when they can't get out of their heads. They can't disengage from the past or the future in order to be present with their partner and their body's sensations. We moderns, as Buddhist teacher Sabine Selassie calls us, are prone to this kind of stuckness, living in our heads as if our minds were just bubbles floating disconnected above our bodies. And it's where a lot of us get stuck when we're trying to get to lust. The specific nature of your office will vary depending on a lot of factors. A woman with ADHD said, "I suspect mine is actually huge and chaotic. I see it as a room filled with precariously stacked boxes that are blocking the access to rooms in my brain." A man with autism said, "I think my office is my favorite place inside my head. And inside my head is my favorite place in the world, so it's a lot of work to drag my attention away from a space full of my favorite toys to go spend time somewhere else." As you consider your thinking mind, all the same questions apply. How do you know you're in this space? What happens in your body, thoughts, and emotions when you're in there? How do you feel about your thinking mind? What spaces are adjacent to it? What pushes or pulls you into it? And what takes you out? The utility room. In addition to all the thoughts and emotions that together make you you, you also have a body. And that body has needs like for food and water and sleep and love. It communicates those needs up to the brain so that the brain can figure out how to get those needs met. I think of the meet basic needs brain processes as the utility room. In a house, this might be the place where the plumbing and the heating and bathroom fixtures and other necessary infrastructure are tucked away. In your brain, it's your need for air, water, food, sleep, and all the physiological necessities of life. Every single one of these needs takes priority over sex. If you are ill, exhausted, or hungry, those are all legitimate brakes-hitting contextual factors that reduce your brain's access to pleasure. We spend our lives checking in on the utility room so that our needs can be met. The second bonus space is observational distance. It is also known by names like mindfulness, self, decentering, or self as context. Going there is the skill of stepping to one side of your internal experience so that you can observe it without being in it. Mindfulness teachers often describe it as a kind of scenic viewpoint, like you find on hiking trails in national parks or along mountain roads. From a distance, we can notice what's happening in our bodies and minds without having an opinion about it or trying to change anything. Notice without trying to change is the key here. Throughout the book, We'll talk about how to create change, and it will almost always involve spending some time at the scenic viewpoint, neutrally noticing our internal experience. We're going to rely on our ability to notice what's happening, to understand and appreciate the ways our minds and bodies are trying to keep us safe and satisfied before we try to change anything. My personal experience of observational distance is so important that I consider it my emotional home base, where I return whenever I want to feel safe inside my own internal experience. If you've tried mindfulness before and hated it, never fear. Any practice that involves witnessing our internal experience as an outside observer without being in it takes us to the scenic viewpoint. Sure, when we practice sitting meditation or yoga or tai chi or mindful breathing, we practice going to the scenic viewpoint. But some people get to the space of observational distance when they exercise. Others get there when they knit. Some get there through music, dance, art. I mostly get there by writing. My spouse gets there by doing something that's just a little bit engaging, mowing the lawn, getting groceries, mindless little games on his handheld game console, and allowing the rest of his mind to wander. If you already know what gets you to the scenic viewpoint, I recommend making whatever it is a regular practice. If you don't yet know what gets you there, begin with an appealing form of rhythmic movement, whether it's yoga, tai chi, Feldenkrais, or dance of any kind, all of which are adaptable to different abilities. If movement is not for you, try a formal mindfulness practice of sitting or lying down while breathing and practicing non-judgmental awareness of your thoughts. As you consider observational distance, all the same questions apply. How do you know you're in this space? What happens in your body, thoughts, and emotions when you're in there? How do you feel about your observational distance? What spaces are adjacent to it? What pushes or pulls you into it? And what takes you out? 9 rooms is a big house. In a house that size, there are bound to be spaces you can't get to without going through some other room, the way you often can't get to the kitchen directly from the bedroom. You have to go through the living room or the dining room or maybe both. If all your biological drives and primary process emotions are spaces in your mental house, the lust room is a room you can't get to directly from every room. You have to go through some other room. The purpose of drawing your emotional floor plan is to figure out which rooms in your house are next door to lust and how to navigate out of the rooms that are far away from lust. When you are stuck in the rage space, how can you find your way to lust? Maybe it's through the living room of care, or maybe it's through play. You'll have to figure out what works for you. There is no right answer. Every individual's floor plan will look different. Now that you have an understanding of each room, try drawing your own floor plan. In the next chapter, I'll show you how to use it. Tips for starting your floor plan. If you're not sure how to start exploring your own floor plan, here are some ideas you might try. On a blank sheet of paper, write the word lust in the middle, and then write the other spaces close to or far away from it on the page. These simple clusters will give you a rough idea of where to start. Alternatively, begin with a space where you feel like you spend the most time. From there, identify what spaces you tend to move into from that space. Tend to oscillate between care and fear? What draws you out of either of those spaces, and where do you go from each? If you're not sure, it can help to identify spaces where you definitely don't go. For example, if you never transition from fear directly into lust, that's helpful information. Get to know each space individually, especially if you're struggling to understand how it fits into your emotional floor plan. Consider names of the different emotions that happen in that space, e.g., for rage, you might have irritation, annoyance, frustration, impatience, as well as anger, hatred, and rage itself. For play, you might have lightheartedness, laughter, ease, friendship, connection, or cheering someone on. Adjectives that describe what it feels like to be in this space, tight or loose, warm or cold, free or trapped, and so on. Objects that would be in this space if it were a literal room in a home, maybe a punching bag in the rage space, a bathtub in the care space, or a ceaseless rain in the panic grief space. A memory of a time when you were in this space, including what put you into it, how it felt to be there, and what moved you out of it. What space did you move into? The answer to that last question tells you if spaces might be close together. This process of exploring your floor plan is itself practice at being in observational distance. As you go through this process, notice when it's easy to stay out of the spaces you're considering and when you get drawn into them, feeling the feelings and thinking the thoughts of the space instead of observing the feelings and noticing the thoughts of the space. Putting the feelings and thoughts on paper or typing on a screen can help you strengthen your skill at shifting to the scenic viewpoint. Chapter 3, TLDR. 1. Our emotional brains have pleasure-favorable spaces, lust, play, seeking, and care, and pleasure-adverse spaces, panic, grief, fear, and rage. Beyond those emotional spaces, we also have our thinking minds, our bodies, and observational distance, the wise, mindful practice of being able to step to one side to witness our internal experience. 2. It is essential for couples in a long-term sexual connection to understand their emotional spaces, knowing how to recognize which space they're in, what moves them into each one, what moves them out, and how they feel about each space. 3. It's also valuable to understand the relationships among the various emotional spaces, which are adjacent to each other, which require a great deal of change in order to transition from one to another. And 4. For couples who like the sex available to them but feel stuck and unable to access the lust space, learning to get to the spaces adjacent to lust can make it easier to move into lust. Some good questions. For each of the pleasure-favorable spaces, how do I know I'm in it? What does it feel like? What pulls me into it? What might push me out? For each of the pleasure-adverse spaces, how do I know I'm in it? What does it feel like? What pushes me into it? What might pull me out? How can I tell which space my partner might be in? What helps transition my partner from an adverse space to a pleasurable one? How do I feel about each of their pleasure-favorable and pleasure-adverse spaces? What are some effective ways my partners and I can communicate to each other what space we are in and what might help us transition to a different one? Can we be present for our partner's difficult feelings, and can our partners be present for our own? Chapter 4, How to Use Your Floor Plan, or Finding the Room Next Door to the Room Where It Happens. The point of understanding all these emotional spaces and how they're related to one another is to learn how to become unstuck and to help a partner become unstuck. Now that you've drawn your emotional floor plan, let's put it to work. First, by aiming for a space adjacent to lust rather than for lust itself, and second, by engaging with your own and your partner's floor plan as third things. You are not turning toward each other directly, you are turning your mutual gaze on these representations of your inner worlds. Don't get too hung up on the idea of a literal floor plan. Doorways can be magical with hidden passages and chutes that carry you from one space to another without anyone seeing how you did it. A door you can walk through in one direction may lock behind you, so you have to exit another way. This is not a literal floor plan. It has secrets and a life of its own because it is you. Aim for the room next door to lust. When I considered my emotional floor plan, I had an insight. I realized that when I tried to go directly from wherever I was to the lust space, I inevitably got lost. What worked better was to aim not for lust itself, but for a space that has a way into lust. I didn't need to find my way to the sexy space. I only needed to find my way to a mental space that was adjacent to the sexy space. So, in this chapter, we are on a search for your room next door to the room where it happens. What is your way in to lust? What is your room next door to the room where it happens? Trace the paths from where you are to where you want to be. Which spaces connect with lust? And what helps you to move out of any given space into a different one? These are the crucial questions when you're struggling to make your way to the lust space. For example, if you're in rage, irritated, or even enraged with your partner, you almost certainly can't get directly from there to lust. You probably don't even want to get to lust, but you can figure out a path from rage to care, which might eventually lead you to lust. Maybe your floor plan is like that of an artist friend of mine whose way in is through drawing their partner. The act of figure drawing shifts their attention into a mode that isn't itself erotic, but it's adjacent to the erotic. It's precise and focused and appreciative, searching for the uniqueness and thus the beauty of the body they're drawing. This is their version of seeking to lust. Maybe your path is like that of a different friend of mine who is a parent of little kids. Watching her partner care for their kids is certainly not erotic, but it takes her to an emotional place in her brain, a place of gratitude and admiration that is much closer to sexy than her mommy mode. This is her version of care to lust. People vary, and they change across their lifespans, and they're all normal. What I did. I'm going to tell you the story of my own search for a new way in, but the moral of the story is not do what I did. It's this simple idea turned out to be difficult, but also it made me a better human and a better wife. Plus, it improved my sex life. You may find the process easier than I did, but I don't want to candy coat it like it's a breeze. Some sexual difficulties have their roots in our childhood bullshit and can't be fixed with tips or tricks or even a good metaphor or a story about someone else's way forward. When I was struggling with desire, I tried asking myself different questions. Sex therapist Gina Ogden would suggest people complete the statement, "I turn myself on when..." And Esther Perel does too. If that prompt elicits great information for you, awesome, use it. But it never elicited anything in me beyond when I masturbate? My turn-ons dwell exclusively in a space of connection with another mind, even if that mind is the author of some erotica I'm reading, or it's a mind I made up in a fantasy. So that really good question didn't happen to be a good fit for me. But then I thought about the emotional spaces in my mind and I asked myself, what is my way in to an erotic state of mind? This is when I realized that seeking is my primary way in, and seeking wasn't working. Everyone I've ever been in love with has been someone whose mind I admired and wanted to explore and learn from. My partner now is no exception. But his mind is different. He's not a scientist or any kind of academic. He's an artist. He thinks in images and spatial relationships, which are my weakest ways of understanding the world. I think in words and human dynamics. So the sociologist, the cognitive scientist, the philosopher, the other philosopher, even the film studies person, they were natural fits with the way my mind works. With all of them, my way into erotic connection was through seeking, my intellect, my curiosity, my social science brain. But with my spouse, that can't be my primary way into erotic connection because that's not a space where he spends a lot of time. He lives in a lot of other spaces where I don't spend a lot of time. Art and design, writing jokes. Those are fun places to go with him, but they are not adjacent to the lust room in my mind. There was a time when I wondered if our erotic connection would work because we couldn't spend much time together in my delightful world of affective neuroscience, parsing precise distinctions between important concepts. Early in our relationship, I tried to connect with him through science, and I just ended up frustrated because he would make jokes, because that's what he does to connect. Neither of us was aware that I was trying to build an erotic connection by talking about science. So neither of us understood why I got so frustrated and felt so lonely because of it. But in all those previous loves where I had entered into the erotic through the intellect, the intellectual connection was solid, and the physical connection was solid, but the emotional connection was a mess. The mess of those shared emotional connections is why all those relationships ended. With my spouse, the emotional connection is bananas. He's so thoroughly there for me. All my decades of practice masking my feelings are nothing to him. He sees right through the mask. He sees me and loves me. He even understands why I need the mask. For all this and more, my emotional connection with him is unlike anything I've experienced with anyone else, and he is stuck with me forever because of it. Sorry, dude. If you were expecting to marry somebody else someday, you should not have been so loving and supportive. But no matter how amazing our emotional connection is, that was never my way into erotic connection. In fact, it was strangely distant from erotic connection. His emotional intelligence, his ability to read my state of mind and meet my needs, put me in a place of safety and balance and peace that felt like the opposite of the erotic. So maybe what should have been my way in, the care space, was actually a dead end. The lack of a way in was a problem I felt ashamed of. And I felt like I could never take it to my partner and get his help with it because I didn't want him to feel criticized or in any way inadequate. When you love someone, you don't want to hurt them, both because you cherish their well-being and because, well, what if they leave you? So I talked about it with my therapist. She found it hard to understand at first. She, like most of you probably, and indeed like most of her other clients, has never found that talking about science is a primary way into erotic connection. But together, we boiled it down to this other really good question. Why does feeling loved shut you down sexually? Well, I mean, hell. My therapist knew the answer because she had been my therapist for many years. It was so obvious, I answered with a joke. Are you suggesting that the household where I grew up with a narcissistic alcoholic and an anxious, agoraphobic, depressed stoic isn't a cradle of stability and connection? Surely not! My therapist smiles patiently at my jokes, but she does not joke back because she knows that under the jokes always lie the biggest, most difficult to express emotions. In this case, it was the reality that my body had learned through the hard experience of my infancy and childhood that love is risky and unreliable. She said I should process all that old emotional stuff so that I could begin to learn that this love is safe. I said that sounded really difficult and uncomfortable, and also it would take a while, and I was looking for a way into lust this week, please. She smiled patiently at that, too. She knows what the jokes are for. Now, the how of therapy is both intensely dramatic and incredibly dull because it's full of emotion and the stakes are high. But also, it's just People sitting in a room talking about those emotions while one of them cries a lot. So I'll summarize my process in three sentences with an 80s movie-style training montage motivational rock anthem. I remembered some moments from my early life that taught me I couldn't rely on love. And I grieved for the little girl that I was, that she would never have the ideal parents every child is born deserving and no child gets. Then I talked through the ways I had grown since then, how I had honed my instincts about which people are trustworthy and which are not, about what healthy love feels like in my body, about how I was now a reliable enough parent to the young, hurt girl who still lives inside me. I cried, sometimes with grief, but also with pride at the adult I had become. Bam! Therapy. Meanwhile, as I did my individual work, my partner and I discovered that we had already found a new way in, one I had never shared with anyone before, one that turns out to be better. Sexier, yes, but more important, better for our relationship and better for me as a human. But I hadn't been able to see it before because I was so busy shoulding on myself about how care should be my way in and I shouldn't rely on intellectual connection. The question we asked together was, what are we doing and how do we feel in the moments when it's easiest to say yes to sex? The answer turned out to be laughter, play, being amused by the silliness of sex, by the seriousness most people have about it, by the entertaining nature of bodies in general and genitals in particular. They're delightful. What is laughter and joking for me? It's a room next door, or maybe it's the room right above, all the biggest, most difficult to express emotions. I could say yes to sex when both of us were willing to laugh together about the reality that I was a sexpert who struggled to drag herself off the couch and into the bed. If I took myself seriously, if I believed there was something at stake, we were doomed. But if I could lighten up my self-criticism and laugh at myself, we were freed. And something happened over the course of our process of discovering laughter as a way in. My body began to unlearn its childhood wisdom about love as a threat. And as my body learned to trust me and this partner I was playing with, the distance between emotional connection and the erotic shrank. Pretty soon, emotional connection wasn't an active turnoff anymore. That is, it didn't hit my brakes. Because my brain was unlearning the link between love and danger. And now, as I read this paragraph about how bananas our emotional connection is, I turn myself on. Now I turn myself on when I write about all the ways I feel supported and accepted for exactly who I am, my oddities, my difficulties, my quirks, and above all, for our shared sense of humor. So I ended up with three potential ways in: intellect, emotional connection, and laughter, which means seeking, care, and play. And don't forget, from chapter 2, we did the things with the door and the rug and the sex towels. Solving sex problems isn't all therapy and feelings. When I tried to draw my floor plan, it took me 3 or 4 drafts to find a layout that seemed to capture most, though not all, of the relationships among all my emotional spaces. Allow yourself multiple attempts. You'll learn a great deal in the process of sorting out how your rooms relate to one another. Everyone has different ways into an erotic state of mind. My sister is a musician, married to a musician, and musicians are not like other people. For them, music is in every emotional space in the brain, care and seeking and play, but also in the adverse spaces. Wherever my sister is in her emotional floor plan, there is music. And because she is married to a fellow musician, that means that wherever she is, she can find him. Musicianship is a partner characteristic that activates her accelerator, so if she's not stuck in adverse space, just listening to him practice can pull her toward lust. The music for this audiobook is a collaboration between her and her musician, and I like to think it nudged them in the direction of their room next door. Music will never be a way in for me and my partner. We're not broken, we're just not musicians. For all I know, care is your room next door. People vary, and they change. Margot and Henry. I once visited a house that had a huge indoor garden with a pool right in the middle of an open-plan living area. It was wild. You could see the pool and the garden lit by massive skylights from almost everywhere in the house. The entire space was pleasantly humid, bright, and bursting with greenery. My friend Henry's floor plan is kind of like that. He constantly dwells in the vicinity of his lust space. It's like even his pleasure adverse spaces have water slides leading down to this lush play space at the center of everything. Before I go any further with Henry and Margot's story, I want to say explicitly that polyamory can be beautiful and happy and life-affirming, as it was for Henry and Margot. And polyamory isn't for everyone. Apart from anything else, the sheer calendar management of it all can be a big task, not to mention the time it takes to check in with everyone's feelings and make sure everyone stays clear about what's happening among and between everyone else. In a monogamous pair, at its simplest, you have to deal with person A's feelings and person B's feelings, plus person A's feelings about person B's feelings, and person B's feelings about person A's feelings. If you add just one additional person, you also have to deal with person C's feelings, plus person C's feelings about person A's feelings, and C's feelings about person B's feelings, A's feelings about C's feelings, and B's feelings about C's feelings, but also A's feelings about B's feelings about C's feelings, and A's feelings about C's feelings about B's feelings, B's feelings about A's feelings about C's feelings, and B's feelings about C's feelings about A's feelings, C's feelings about A's feelings about B's feelings, and C's feelings about B's feelings about A's feelings. It's not just additively complex, it is exponentially more complex. It requires time, excellent communication skills, unusually high self-awareness, and did I mention time? Trying to solve relationship difficulties by opening the relationship up to other people makes as much sense as trying to solve relationship difficulties by having a child. You might feel really good about this new person in your lives, but that doesn't mean you've actually fixed any of your problems, and now you're imposing them on someone else. Everyone's experience is unique. But I think it's not a coincidence that the people I know who are most successful at open relationships that involve not just sexual connections, but deep emotional connections, are retired. They have the time, the emotional maturity, and often a couple of decades of therapy under their belts, all of which make such expansive love more practicable. Not that Henry and Margot and their various partners over the decades never ran into problems. All relationships run into problems. In fact, 2 decades into their relationship, Margot was stuck in the pleasure-adverse spaces in her floor plan, while Henry was still slipping playfully down the water slides of his emotional brain into lust. Margot's floor plan has lust over in a corner, sandwiched between care and play, with all the adverse spaces over on the other side of the house. Their "what do we want when we want sex" answers had led them to try prying her out of those adverse spaces, pushing her toward the favorable spaces. But as we've seen so far, you get pushed into adverse spaces and have to be pulled out, just as you get pulled into favorable spaces. "How do we get you unstuck?" Henry asked with enthusiastic optimism, because, did I mention, he is the Ted Lasso of polyamorous erotic connections. "What do you need?" Well, the first thing I need is definitely to feel like your next big project, Margot answered facetiously. The mundane exigencies of life conspired to turn one special weekend into a slightly less special, much more convenient weekend at Margot's place. They spent the evening cooking dinner together and talking about the repairs the house needed and the addition she had been dreaming of building for a decade. At the bottom of their shared bottle of Pinot Noir, Margot fought sleep and lost. I gotta go to bed. Can we try again tomorrow?
Sure,
Henry said. I'll tidy the kitchen a little and follow you up. He did follow her up to find Margot already asleep. She was still asleep when he woke up the next morning. When Margot went downstairs after 10 surprisingly satisfying hours of sleep, not since perimenopause had she reliably slept through the night, she found the kitchen cleaned, breakfast warming in the oven, and Henry nowhere in sight. She took her morning dose of anti-inflammatories, and then, listening carefully, she followed the muffled sounds of singing and whistling to the laundry room, where she found Henry. He was naked, except for Margot's flowery apron, which came to about mid-thigh on him, pulling laundry out of the dryer, folding it, and piling it into a basket. As he folded, he danced and sang The Wallflower, a.k.a. Roll With Me, Henry, the Etta James Grammy Hall of Fame award-winning hit from his childhood. She watched him silently, not wanting to interrupt, wanting to watch his unselfconscious silliness for as long as it lasted. But eventually the dryer was empty and the basket was full, and Henry hoisted the basket onto his hip and turned toward the door. When he saw her, he declared, "Well, good morning." And, well, let's fade to black on this scene. This isn't that kind of book. But suffice it to say that she rolled with him. That day, they learned that one path out of Margot's pleasure-adverse spaces was this delightful blend of being cared for in the care space combined with play. It was the beginning of some curious exploration of unexpected strategies to get Margot out of the difficult spaces and into the pleasure-favorable ones. Your floor plans are a third thing. Talking about your emotional floor plan with your partner is a project, a third thing toward which you can turn your shared attention. Doing so will not only help you create a context that allows you to access the lust space, but it will also help you to make things less stressful or fraught when either of you is struggling to get to lust. An example of how one couple used the floor plan. Eric, the higher desire partner, had started to take it personally when Dana, the lower desire partner, declined sex. Dana talked to Eric about feeling stuck in the care kitchen. I'm always here. There is no path from here to sex. Instead of calling me when you're in the sex room and I'm in the kitchen, meet me where I am and help me finish all the caregiving that has to happen in the kitchen so I can step away. Walk with me on the path between the kitchen and the sex room. Pausing in the office so I can make sure all my to-dos are crossed off and I can let go of the taking care of responsibilities and we can care for each other. In this couple's case, it meant integrating householding into date night. Part of their scheduled, planned foreplay was cleaning the literal kitchen together, washing, drying, and putting away the dishes, wiping down counters and appliances. I learned of this story because Dana shared with me the moment Eric, spontaneously and unasked, dried the sink with a dish towel, then put the used dish towel in the laundry and replaced it with a clean one. For Dana, this simple yet extravagant act felt exactly like being told, "I love you." Another example, a lower desire husband's lust space was locked up tight, doors shut, and bolted following years of scripted sex that demanded performance and being the man. Both he and his higher desire wife believed in the gendered instructions they had been taught since childhood, so they both believed his erections were a measure not only of his masculinity, but also of his desire for her, his commitment to their relationship, and his ability to meet her needs in every domain of their relationship. When you shine a spotlight on a penis and demand that it perform or else, does that activate the accelerator? For a lot of people, including this guy, the pressure and performance demand hit the brakes, making erection impossible. Worse, he could barely talk about it, since even just discussing sex would be like admitting failure. His wife learned about the emotional floor plan and brought it to him with great enthusiasm. She explained all about her floor plan, describing how each room felt for her and which rooms were adjacent to lust. She drew it and everything with arrows showing how she moved through one space into another. He didn't do any of that. Explaining what it felt like to be in each room was not an option for him in that moment. He was too overwhelmed. Thinking about the relationship among all the spaces was way too much to get his head around. But he could point at the panic grief space on his wife's drawing, and he could say, "I'm over here." He was in tune enough with his internal experience to be able to identify it, even if he didn't have a lot of practice talking about it. Given a bunch of potential labels, he could match his internal experience to one of them. His wife had assumed he was somewhere in the rage space, angry with her for pushing him, angry that he didn't feel in control. But when he pointed to panic grief, she suddenly saw that her understanding of their struggle was wrong. The solutions when a partner is in rage are completely different from when a partner is in panic grief. Given the extremity of isolation and hopelessness that came with his experience of being trapped in panic grief, their next step was the right one. They went to therapy together. Therapy is an answer like mindfulness or compassion. Like, ugh, can't you just tell me what to do, how to fix it, instead of having to deal with all these feelings? I sure do wish I could. But great sex in a relationship that lasts decades requires your whole personhood and your partner's whole personhood. It means knowing your whole emotional floor plan and being able to talk about every room, including the uncomfortable ones. It isn't always easy. But when your partner can say to you, "I feel lonely in our relationship," even if all they do is point at a picture and say, "I'm over here," that's some powerful motivation. One more example, because I love how varied people are. Amber, not her real name, and her non-binary partner are nestmates in an open relationship, and she told me that both of them experience desire as mostly responsive in their shared sexual connection. But she told me that she experiences spontaneous desire for her non-nesting partners. She said, "It's easy because, you know, I don't see them all the time, and when I do, it's a celebration. It's playtime. It's relaxed and fun and like recess." Yet with her primary partner, Amber said, "We're both so responsive. It's like we're both waiting for the other one to get things started and make that, like, spark." I said, "I'm curious what's so important about that spark before other things happen." She had a hard time explaining just what was important about the spark, so I asked a different question. "What is it that you want when you experience the spark?" Her answer? "I just want to get super close to my partner, literally like smush up against them." Amber's spark was a desire for closeness, which explains why it was easy to feel a spark for non-nesting partners whom she saw less frequently. That means that her room next door to lust is care. Specifically, missing someone she cared for. If you like someone a lot and you don't spend a lot of time with them, of course you want to be closer. By contrast, it's difficult to miss someone you see every day for many hours a day. A pleasurable longing to be closer to someone she misses was Amber's way into her lust space, through care, with a tiny dash of panic grief. That made things so simple. I said, the usual advice is to create that spark of missing each other simply by separating from each other for a while. She said, oh, this is that thing Esther Perel talks about, maintaining distance. Right, I said, but there are other options too. What if, when you schedule your intimate time together, instead of thinking about it as, how are we going to create this spark of longing, you forget about longing, and instead, you try to bring all the pleasure you can to your partner. Like, how can I bring lots of pleasure to this person who is so amazing and great, and with whom I share a huge part of my life? That way, you're not waiting for a spark. You're igniting it yourself with care or play or seeking. Stop longing to miss them, and instead, long to give them pleasure. Oh my gosh, that sounds so much nicer, she said. Instead of showing up for sexy times worried about how to create a spark with this person she adored, she would show up with the goal of giving pleasure to her beloved nestmate. It was a small shift, but it was a new way in through the room next door. The cost of context switching. I'm confident that anyone hearing this is capable of making significant improvements in their sex life, regardless of how good it already is or how bad it has gotten. But I will never try to make it seem effortless because I know that A, lots of the things I recommend in this book take a great deal of effort, and B, knowing ahead of time that something will be effortful helps you not give up if the going ever gets seriously tough. That's why I need you to know about context switching. In both computer programming and the kind of productivity books that make me feel exhausted just looking at them, context switching is the process of switching from one task to another. This process costs time and energy. Switching to a different task or role, say from work mode to parent mode, or from parent mode to sexy mode, takes time and energy. It rarely happens spontaneously or without intention. Our brains need to switch periodically, and different people have different needs when it comes to switching. For example, I benefit from staying in the same task for long periods of time. At the time of writing this paragraph, I had been at my desk for 4 hours solid, while my attention deficit disorder spouse benefits from switching very frequently, as guided by his distractible but highly creative brain. He frequently has over 100 tabs open in his web browser. For both of us, if the outside world demands that we switch our attention or maintain our attention at times when our brains aren't ready, we may be using more energy on the switch than we are on any task we're actually working on, leaving us potentially exhausted. Can you relate? You're in the middle of a task, finally grabbing a few minutes in a row to concentrate on one thing, and along comes a child in need. Or you're focused on a project when an email comes in. Or someone sticks their head into your line of sight, or you get a reminder that there's a meeting in 10 minutes and you need to stop your actual productive work and go be in a meeting. These are just a few of the moments when we experience the cost of context switching. There will be times in your life when you lack the time, the energy, or both to transition out of your everyday tasks and mental states into the lust space in your brain. That's life. That's fine. And there will be times in your life when you have the time and energy to reach a state of whole brain immersion in lust, where all your attention is free to focus on the pleasurable things happening in the moment. This is the sex people want and like when they talk about freedom, when they are released into a shared spaciousness, dissolving of barriers, intense connection, and ecstasy. In my nerdy terms, what they want and like is a whole brain context switch to the lust room. They want to dwell there and not have to worry about anything outside that space. You probably want me to explain how to get to that state if you don't already know. I will. That's the last chapter. To sustain a strong long-term sexual connection, Know your emotional floor plan and your partner's. Know which mental spaces are adjacent to the erotic, and know how to help each other transition out of the distant spaces, like worry and frustration, into the spaces right next door to lust. Given all the different states of mind that have no doorway directly into lust, it is nonsense to imagine sex should just happen. The shift from one mental space to another takes time, effort, and energy, and often we need help from our partners to make it happen. People vary too much, and the potential barriers to the lust room are so diverse and numerous that you and your partner are the only ones who can work out how to protect that space in your relationship. And let's never forget that sometimes you are so overwhelmed and exhausted that you can't get off the couch. Then date night arrives and you just don't have enough energy left to be anything but a blob. If you're just that exhausted, here is your official permission slip not to even try to get to the lust when what you really need is 10 naps and a good messy cry. You do not owe anyone a further justification or explanation. Your permission slip. Please excuse your name here from whatever sexual activity. They just can't. They have lost the ability to can. Signed, Emily Nagoski, PhD. This permission slip is reusable an infinite number of times. Chapter 4, TLDR. 1. Aim not for lust itself, but for a space next door to it. 2. Your emotional floor plans are helpful tools for exploring the internal experience part of your shared erotic context. Again, couples who sustain a strong sexual connection over the long term co-create a context that makes pleasure easier to access. 3. It took me time, therapy, and the curious, supportive cooperation of my partner to help me discover new ways into the lust space. You don't have to hurry in your exploration of your emotional floor plans. 4. Moving through emotional spaces takes both time and energy. It isn't, and isn't supposed to be, effortless. It's a myth that wanting and liking sex should happen easily, instantly, and in any context. Some good questions. Which mental states are right next door to the lust room? What is my way in to an erotic state of mind? What am I doing and how do I feel in the moments when it's easy to say yes to sex? What am I doing and how do I feel in the moments when I can't imagine saying yes to sex?